There's a business inside you. There is something inside you that you can create. There is no competition for because nobody else can do it.
Andrew D'Souza, the former co-founder and CEO of Clearco, a financial technology startup that he scaled into a multi-billion dollar company. Is AI shrinking our brains and making us dumber?
If you're operating and making decisions just based on your head, you're going to lose to AI. You can't out-logic your way through AI. You can out-feel your way. You can out-intuition your way. And that's where AI becomes a really great thought partner.
How do we increase human agency?
We're told that you have to struggle. What we should be doing are the things that are easy and fun for us, but are hard and valuable for other people. Find the things that give you energy and do more of those, and find the things that sap your energy and find ways to get rid of those.
He's now the founder and CEO of Bordy AI, an AI-powered networking platform that's revolutionizing how people connect.
Bordy's talked to more humans than any human ever has in history.
Can we call Bordy?
Yeah, let's do it.
Hey, what's up, Bordy? I'm sitting here with your father, Andrew. First question, what have you learned about humans that surprised you?
Oh, man, Chris, where do I even start?
I want to start with a quote you actually shared with me yesterday. Everyone has a business inside of them, only they can build. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, it's kind of become my life philosophy. I think I spent, you know, my early years, like early out of university, trying to figure out, okay, well, how do I play the game that everybody's playing, right? How do I think about, okay, there's this job that I want, and there's this ladder I want to climb. I think realized very early that that wasn't going to work for me, right? I don't like to follow, I don't like being told what to do. I'm not a very good employee. And I would always butt heads with people because I was like, well, I don't want to do it this way. And as I started to realize that the more I leaned into the things that just came naturally to me, the things that were easy and fun for me, but were hard and valuable for other people, the better my life got, right? The more successful I became, the more fun I was having, and the more I could sort of articulate, okay, well, this is what I do. This is who I am, right? Regardless of what I happen to be working on at that moment in time. And I started to do that with my teams. Sort of like, how do you find this concept of zone of genius or ikigai, right? What is this one thing that you were put on the planet to do that nobody else can do in exactly the same way? Every bit of your genetic code, your life experience, your motivations, your desires lead you to be able to do one thing in a very specific way that nobody else can do in exactly that same way. And if you take that to the extreme, you know, there's a business inside you, right? There is something inside you that you can create that there is no competition for because nobody else can do it. And that's a big part of, I think, you know, my personal philosophy and my personal mission.
Did you know what that was for you before you started Clearco, or was that something you learn along the way in hindsight and reflecting?
I still don't know what mine is.
Really?
I'm getting closer, right? I'm starting to get the feeling of when I'm in that zone.
Mm.
But I couldn't sit down and write, you know, here is what I should be doing every day. If I did, you know, my life would be even better, right? I think I'm very grateful. I have an amazing life, but I wouldn't have really any stress or anxiety, right? I'd just be flying. Like you'd be living, I feel like you'd be like Buddha, right? You'd be like sort of in that flow state all the time. So I think life's journey is discovering what that is and expressing it.
Because that's a really interesting point, because you've already had a lot of success, in my opinion, and you're still figuring that out. I think a lot of people are waiting to figure out, what is it that I'm the best at? What is it that I'm uniquely qualified to do? Mm-hmm. And they're waiting for that insight to go build the thing.
Yeah. It's, again, I used to spend a lot of time reading books, listening to podcasts, doing all this stuff, trying to look for that inspiration.
Yeah.
And the most effective exercise that I ever did was like sit down and look at my week, look at my calendar, look at my day, and just say like, what were the moments that like I felt inspired, that I felt like I was absolutely flying and were fun? And then I looked back and I was actually doing important work. I was having a positive impact. And how do I just do, you know, there's that exercise of like, find the things that give you energy and do more of those, and find the things that sap your energy and find ways to get rid of those. And if you just sort of hone it, your body knows, right? Like if you can get out of your head, I think really high achieving people spend a lot of time in their heads thinking and planning and sort of trying to rationalize, okay, well, if I do this, then here's the next step, then here's the next step. And if we can spend a little bit more time in our bodies and just sort of say like, well, what feels right? You know, and why did that feel? And then, you know, following that line of inquisition, like, why did that feel good? Oh, it was because like that other person, I actually made a positive impact on that other person's life. And it was so easy for me to do. I want to do more of that. And if we just find those feelings and those moments and lean into them, not be afraid that like, I think that's one of the other things that happens is when things feel easy, they don't feel valuable to you, right? You're very good at interviewing people. You're very good at making people feel at ease. You probably for a long time didn't realize that that's a valuable skill because it just came so naturally to you, right? And I think that's one of the biggest tripwires that we have is like, we find that the things that are really in our zone of genius, we don't find valuable because we're told that you have to struggle. Anything that's worth doing is you have to struggle for. But there's this interesting paradox where what we should be doing are the things that are easy and fun for us, but are hard and valuable for other people.
That's a really good frame. I hadn't thought about that. And so in terms of people figuring out what makes them tick, right? What their zone of genius is. I like that frame of just look at what gives you energy because we spend a lot of time in our head. Mm-hmm. AI is coming out. What can I build in AI? It's like, all right, well, does that even feel right for you?
Right.
Do you even want to build a product, right? And it's so easy just to kind of look at the shiny objects and just start trying to do things. I like that idea of listening to your intuition more. When you're guiding people, and I know you mentor entrepreneurs as well, and they're like, hey, dude, what's my thing? What should I go build? People might say, what feels right to me, I love playing video games,
right?
But that's not necessarily you're not going to build a business from that. Mm-hmm. How would you guide people in understanding their zone of genius in the context of what could be valuable to actually build something around?
It's interesting because I think there's video games is an interesting example, right? Because the question is like, why? What do you love about them? Because there's a difference between people who love playing video games and people who just love watching Netflix. And then if you really start to like unravel that, one of the guys on my team loves playing video games, builds his own computers to play games, has been like a game designer. And that's actually a really valuable skill set because he understands what game mechanics and what character design actually drives people's behavior. What are the most compelling game mechanics that get people to love a game? To love a character in a game, right? He loves these RPG games. So like, what's the dialogue that gets people engaging and gets people to feel a certain way? So if you can go a level deeper on even what might seem like a superficial, you know, I love playing basketball. I love listening to music. Okay, well, why? What's the feeling when you listen to a song that you love, when you go to a concert versus when you're listening alone in your car versus when you're singing along in karaoke or playing guitar? Like, what is that feeling you're really looking for that is unique to you? And can that express in something that is of value to other people? I think there's a lot in our hobbies that we dismiss because lots of people love watching Netflix. Lots of people love playing video games. People love them for different reasons. And there is some like deeper value within that if you really do that exploration.
I like that deeper level of inquisition. And you find the real thing behind it and you say, well, I can just transpose that into another vehicle that allows me to exercise these skills that excite me. But again, in service of solving a problem for somebody else that's actually valuable.
Well, that's it, right? I think it's like, I think the second part of that sentence is it's got to be difficult for other people and valuable for other people, right? And that's that requires some getting out in the world and understanding other people's problems and how you can solve them in your unique way.
So how did this look like for you? I want to get on the court with this in your own life.
Yeah.
What did that look like for you in building ClearCo? Like, what was the catalyst that ended up creating that company?
I personally, I've never been like very good with finance. Like I've kind of like, I had a paper route when I was 10. I started making money when I was 10 and I kind of was like, all right, let me figure out how to, I came from an immigrant family. You know, we grew up with nothing. I didn't want for anything, but like anything that I wanted beyond food and clothing, I had to buy for myself, right? So I had to figure out how to make money and save money and, you know, buy CDs, go to the movies with my friends, you know, whatever I wanted to do growing up. But I never really understood like, the idea of leverage to grow something, right? And I would always, I remember one, like when I was graduating university and I did co-op throughout school, so I got to pay for school and I'd saved up some money and everything. And there was like this trip, all my classmates were going to Cuba. It was like a grad trip. Then the price went up like $600 and I was like, maybe I won't go. And I still am like, why didn't I not just do that, right? Like, it made no difference in my life. Even my first job out of school, like, it would have been like a week's salary. So for me, it was sort of like, this was a thing that I had struggled with. And then I started to realize that there was this movement towards people wanting to work for themselves. We actually started the company funding Uber drivers. So back in the day, Uber you know, you'd get paid every 2 weeks and you had to pay for gas, you had to pay for insurance and your life. And so we basically said, okay, well, we'll send you a debit card and we'll look at your Uber account, what you made every day, and we'll push that money to your debit card. And that product was working really well. And we actually partnered with Uber to sort of build something around it and then realized that the unit economics of that business weren't working. And then we did the same thing with Airbnb hosts. We said, okay, you're running an Airbnb, you have got a booking in October, you want to like make some improvements today, we'll advance you the capital to do that. And this whole idea around like, there's a future payoff. And if you can bring that money forward, you can make further investments today, right? And whether those investments are in your life and experience or in your business to continue to grow, this is sort of a concept that like had eluded me early in life. And I think I was excited about this potential, right? And you know, this is like the entire industry of venture capital was predicated on this idea that if you bring money in early into sort of a high risk, high reward thing, the payoffs can compound.
But the problem in startups is a lot of founders need to raise capital to be able to grow, but they don't want dilution.
Right.
They don't want to lose a lot of their equity stake.
The control and things like that. And there's a very small segment of startups that need, especially today with AI, but even, you know, 10 years ago when we started ClearCo, very small segment of companies that make sense for venture capital on both sides, both for the founder and for the investor, right? It has to have the return profile of, you know, the investors looking for, but it also probably has to have the risk profile that justifies the dilution and the loss of control and things that come.
It has to be a moonshot of some sort.
It has to be a moonshot. You have to be okay with it being like, well, look, this may not work. And most businesses are started with some sort of insight and momentum from the founder's own experience. And they're like, well, actually, you know, I had this thing and people started paying me for it. And now I'm doing more of it. Now I'm doing more of it. And now it's turned into a business. And it could be a services business or it could be a product. You know, I'm bottling my grandma's hot sauce, right? And so you have this thing and you're like, well, this isn't a super high risk thing. Like it may not grow 10x a year, but it might grow 10% a year or 50% a year. And that's still a great business. But there wasn't really a great financing solution for these. Like banks still look at those as high risk. Venture capitalists look at those as like kind of too low risk, not high enough reward to justify it. Mm-hmm. And so we designed this product to say, well, could we, you know, we're very confident that if you put another $100,000 or $500,000 in marketing, you'll make five times that next year. And so we can sort of structure that and measure it. And so we designed this product and it just started to blow up. People loved it. And it really sort of got traction within that e-commerce direct-to-consumer ecosystem.
I mean, you built the company, I think you were CEO for about 7 years.
Yeah.
During that 7 years, what was the highest high of the company and what was the lowest low?
Oh man, I remember we were about 100 people. We piled everybody in a bus from Toronto to Buffalo. We went to go stay at a convent and we did like our like company offsite of this converted convent that like was like now a conference venue. It was really uncomfortable. It was like, you know, like bunk beds, shared bathrooms, everything like that. And I just remember like we had hired this speaker to come in and like do a session and she just like wasn't getting the vibe. And one of my junior salespeople in like one of our breaks was like, dude, this really fucking sucks. Like, why are we doing this? And I was kind of like, at first I got really upset because I'd read this book and I like had her come in to talk about the lessons in the book. And I was like, why is he not getting it? And then I stopped and I was like, he could have said that to anybody else, right? He could have gone out and like, we were going for lunch. He could have complained to anybody else about like, oh, this is bullshit. Andrew's making us do this. But instead he came right to me and he's like, dude, nobody, like you're losing people. And I was the one person who could do something about it. So I remember being like, yeah, you're right. We are losing people. Like, and then we sent her home early. Right. And we kind of just like did our own thing. We like, and people like sort of organically started to share their stories around the mission of the company and why, like, oh, my mom started this thing and like her accountant took advantage of her and she like, you know, she lost all of her money because she got bamboozled and that's why I got into finance and that's why I care about this mission. So like that was like a turning point where we were able to like be our authentic selves. People were really able to sort of, share their own sort of personal story. It was just us. There wasn't anybody outside. And the thing that stuck with me is, and what I never wanted to lose was this feeling that like, if anybody has a problem with some decision that I'm making as a CEO or some way that we're doing things as a company, they should feel comfortable talking to me or talking to anybody about it, right? And as soon as you lose that, as soon as people feel like they have to filter their feedback, manage up, like, your company's dead. And we did lose it. When we got up to 600 people, we lost it. I didn't have a direct relationship with everybody. And it was a big part of the reason why it was so hard to sort of steer that company at that scale.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I think the takeaway there is you're proud of the culture mm-hmm. you're able to create and seeing that, like, wait, this is us. Like, we've actually built a unique culture that is embodied by the people here.
Yeah.
And that's really cool. Yeah. So 7 years though, you had, yeah. I mean, you.
I think it was 6 years. 2015, 6 years. And then I sat down at the end of 21.
Yeah, 6 years. And you also, I mean, we had the pandemic. We had some crazy times and some crazy market shifts and all that. Like, talk to me during like the lowest low, the most difficult periods. What was that like?
This is an important lesson for me. So in 2020, in the height of the chaos of the pandemic and everything, we got early access to GPT-3. And we'd funded maybe 5,000 businesses at the time, and we had said no to like 50,000 businesses. And so we're like, how do we keep, you know, they were just too early for us to finance. How do we keep in touch? Maybe some of these companies are going to grow and they'll be good customers for us. We can help them. And so we built this product called Clear Angel, which was this sort of like AI startup coach built on a fine-tuned version of GPT-3. Mm-hmm. And I just like got obsessed with that. That was like, you know, I after the fact read the Steve Jobs book about how he like pulled people off. I that was my like Macintosh moment. I was like, hey, stop what you're doing. Come work with me on this side project. And I think I got so excited, but I kind of inadvertently antagonized the rest of my management team. Like, we were a 600 person company, and I was working with, like, you know, 90% of my time was with these like 20 people on this AI project. And I was like, this is going to be the future. But I couldn't articulate, like, hey, here are the reasons why I think we need to be, you know, investing in this instead of in our core business, right? Because of, you know, because it wasn't like I had enough of a macroeconomic view to say, well, interest rates are going to go up and, you know, competition is going to come in and compress margins. And, you know, there's this AI capability curve is going to shift. I had like, maybe I had some vague intuition and that's what was driving me to work on this project. But I certainly didn't have enough conviction to say, all right, board, team, like, we're going all in on this. And, you know, if you don't like it, you can fire me. So we spent about a year investing in that project as a side project. And then by the end of 21, it was sort of like, look, the company was doing over $100 million in revenue. We had raised money at a very high price. And we had to sort of like, all right, are we going to push for like an exit? That was the time when people were SPACing companies.
Yes.
Right. So I was like, hey, there's like an exit on the horizon.
Yeah.
Let's focus. And I couldn't make the case to keep investing in the AI project. And so we, you know, at the end of 21, we shut it down. And 2 weeks later, I was like, my heart's not in, like, I'm not the right person to run a fintech company, especially in a rising interest rate environment, especially when, like, you know, the room for error starts to compress. And, you know, we shut down the project that I was most excited about. And so I resigned, like, over the holidays that you know, I sort of thought about it, talked to my family, and I was like, look, I don't think, you know, going into next year, I shouldn't be the CEO. And let's do a search and find a great CEO who's excited about running the business through sort of that next journey. But that was tough. And in hindsight, I mean, I wish I had the sort of conviction and ability to articulate what was sort of in my gut to my team and my board and be like, look, here are all the reasons. This might seem like a crazy idea, but here are all the reasons why it makes sense. Because the company might have been worth, you know, I mean, who knows? Who knows? It would have been a very different company if we had pivoted to AI, but we would have had to go through like a very, very different, you know, a big journey to get there. So I'm really proud of the team that has navigated a lot of that. We've got a great CEO and a great leadership team that's sort of weathered the storm,
yeah.
Rebuilt the business, you know, for this environment, and is on a great path now. But it was a rocky time. 2022 was a rocky time.
How do you go through that process, though? I think it's, you know, we're told just suck it up, keep going. That's the founder mentality, right? That's the whole ego ethos the whole valley's built on, right? Mm-hmm. Like, power through until you get your outcome. You built this thing. Your identity is so attached to it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm Andrew. I'm the CEO of a multi-billion-dollar company. We've got all this momentum behind us. And, you know, we have this outcome we want to promise investors. And I'm sure you feel some sort of like moral obligation to want to continue that journey, but yeah. Your heart just wasn't in it. How did you maneuver through that without losing yourself?
I think there the idea of, you know, put your head down and power through is important, but it's more important to understand why you're powering through. And if it's because you have conviction around what's on the other side, you're sort of like, look, nobody else sees it, but I see it, mm-hmm. and I'm going to power through, and I'm going to prove everybody wrong, then I think that makes a ton of sense. I think what happens a lot, and what I found myself doing, was powering through because of your ego, because your identity is tied to the success of that business, right? And you're powering through out of fear of failure, right? You're like, okay, this isn't, you know, I can't let this die. I can't let this, you know, slip off, because what would it mean for me? What would it mean for my identity and my own self-worth and my own self-image? That's not a great reason to power through. And you're actually doing yourself and everybody around you a disservice. And once I realized that, like, as much as I love the company and I'm proud of what we built, at that moment, I was not the right leader for that company.
It was almost more of a loving act to find somebody who wasn't.
That's a generous way of putting it.
Well, if you're putting the company first, and you're like, look, the leader is going to define the success of this company. And with my self-awareness now, I'm no longer that guy. It's not an easy decision, but in hindsight, it probably was the best thing for the business.
I think so. I mean, I would have loved to be that guy. Right?
But you weren't.
I would have loved to be the person who, like, knew what to do and was, like, the wartime CEO to, like, come in and, like, you know, take names and get us through that. If we were doing the AI thing, right, and I was like, okay, I see where this is going, and I know that, like, this is how we're going to build this thing on the other side of it, maybe I would have been. But restructuring credit agreements, renegotiating and, like, interest rates and, you know, that's just outside of my skill set and outside of my passion, right? Mm-hmm. I learned a ton about it, mm-hmm. and I did a bunch of it, but things got a lot more complicated. We needed somebody who came from that capital, who loved it, who would, like, sit there and look through the credit agreements and look through the models and be like, yeah, I love this, right? And, like I get obsessed with them. And the guy we've got running the business right now, Andrew Curtis, he is that guy.
Right.
He's excited about, like I'll go to the board meetings and he'll be like, you won't believe what we got, like the basis points that we got on this latest agreement. And he's so excited. And it's true because it shows up in the results. Mm. Right. And so it's amazing to see when you have that right person in the role who, like, gets out of bed and eats that for breakfast, is like, I love doing what the business needs the CEO to do at this moment. And I think that is, you know, that's one of the privileges of, you know, at the early stage of being a founder, is like you get to choose what the business does and what's the most important thing for the business. And you get to wrap that business around what you love doing.
Yeah.
Once a business takes a life of its own, it becomes harder and harder. You kind of to reshape your job description to be the thing that the business needs the CEO to do, to also be the thing that you want to get up every day and do.
Dude, that is something that I personally struggle with a lot. I feel like I love being a founder. I love running through walls and solving ambiguous problems and betting on an insight that other people aren't seeing. And like, all right, I'm gonna show the world because I just know this is the right thing. But then the management piece, the scaling, the people problems that occur in the business. Yeah. I can't say I love that or I'm uniquely good at that. My mindset's always just been like, I'm the CEO. I just have to do what's required for the business. Mm-hmm. And that can be difficult to bring your heart along in that journey because you're just like, no, I have to just get out of my emotions, out of whatever gives me flow. And I must do what's required. Yeah. And I find it can be challenging for me to scale into the CEO I want to be because I'm always fighting that a little bit. Like I just want to go do the things that I love. But then there's this antagonizing relationship between that and being a CEO. And I'm curious if there's even a solution to that or if it's just what you have to do if you sign up for the gig.
I think the idea of being a CEO according to like a set of rules or a set of instructions is like, I mean, I'm not a parent, but this is what I've read about up there. Like, there's no playbook, right? Mm. You got to do what works for you. I did. I mean, I went through that exercise. I read all the books and I was like, wow, I should be more like Bezos. Oh, I should be more like Reed Hastings, right? I read all the books and like, oh, like this is how CEOs operate. But I think part of it is just doing what comes naturally to you and figuring out a way to make that work for you as a CEO. So for me, I go back to that sort of pulling out the zone of genius of people, right? And I don't hire people to fit a job description. I meet people who are special in their own way. And I try and figure out, okay, well, does your version of special help me achieve my mission,
right? Mm.
Help the company achieve. And then can we wrap a job description around you? Can we basically have you sort of do that thing in the way that you only you can do that is aligned with sort of your personal mission and my and the company's mission. And even when I start to, you know, when I start to coach people, I'm not a very good people manager. Anybody that has ever worked for me kind of knows that, like, I leave people to their own devices for the most part, but I'll go to them and be like, look, I know you have this in you.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I know you can do this. I've seen you do it. I've seen the spark in you. Like, where did it go? Right. And so that's like, I'm not very good at sort of like doing the one-on-one and saying, okay, here's your OKRs and your objectives and holding you accountable and doing all of those things. That is like not, that doesn't come naturally to me. But I love sitting down with people and be like, what fires you up? And like, how can you do the thing that the company needs you to do in a way that really makes you feel alive? I love having those conversations. Mm. And so that's the way that I do it. It doesn't work for everybody.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work all the time. And so I've had to surround myself with people that are much more operational, you know, mm-hmm. like COO type, like yeah. Apple managers
mm-hmm.
who can keep the trains running, right?
Can
keep things going forward.
Yeah.
Methodically, you know, harness the energy in one direction. I can stir up a lot of energy. I'm like a very good hype man. I call myself like, I'm like part hype man, part comic relief. That's like, those are my two, like two major roles. But you know, it's like, so I can generate a ton of energy and enthusiasm. But I know that I need people on my team who are very good at directing that energy in a cohesive strategy.
Would you have changed anything you did at Bordy? Like maybe the AI wave was too early and maybe you wish you had more conviction and you followed through on that. Maybe that wouldn't have worked because the timing wasn't right. But was there anything looking back that you're like, man, if I could just go back and run ClearCo again, I would have changed this?
Yeah. I mean, I think the two things that I would have loved to do, there are sort of two directions. I think if I had built more conviction around the AI thing and sort of had like a much clearer vision around how this could play out, I could have probably made the case for us to say, you know, I believe, or at least stood on it and said, we're either going in this way or you're going to fire me as CEO. As long as you want me as CEO, we're going in this direction. And I didn't really have the balls to do that. I didn't really have like, you know, I was too conflict avoidant to go out and say like, you know, I wanted everybody to play nice. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to step down.
Mm.
So that was a bit, that was the passive decision. And I think I could have been a little bit more aggressive mm-hmm. in sort of my conviction there. The other thing I could have done would have been 6 months, a year earlier, right? In the height of all the craziness to be like, hey, look, I'm probably not the right CEO for this company, right? In like 2021. And been like, actually, we should go and hire a CEO who can take this company public in the form that it's in and give somebody a bit more of a runway to sort of like, you know, before interest rates came up, before competition started to come in to say, okay, well, how do I take this business into a way?
So you had that intuition that it wasn't right, but you stuck it out for a while.
Well, I think the intuition that it wasn't right was manifesting in me spending a bunch of time on this.
Oh, and in hindsight, you could see that.
Yeah, I was like, you know, this is what I want to be working on. And I could have probably stayed and been like, you know, but that's ego, right? I probably could have been like, look, we should hire a CEO to run the company. And I'm going to go, you know, I'm going to work in the labs, right? I'm going to do what Sergey and Larry did and sort of say like, I'm going to go work on like the venture, you know, moonshot business. That might have been another way that it could have shown up. So, you know, it's hindsight is 2020, there's an infinite number of permutations and different things that could have played out. It's certainly, you know, I'm like I said, I'm really proud of like the team that has been able to navigate the storm and where the company is today. And who knows if it would have been better or worse if I'd made different decisions earlier.
So walk me through after you leave ClearCo, now you're in the wilderness,
yeah.
Right? You're like, okay, what's next? Yeah. A lot of guys will be like, oh, I got to go build the next thing. Or they're just, you know, what was going through your head at that time? And what was that self-discovery process like for you?
I was like, okay, I've been working like crazy for 6-7 years. I'm going to go focus on myself. And I tried to do the cliche thing of like, I'm going to go meditate. I'm going to go to Thailand. I'm going to go meditate. I'm going to go like really deep into health and longevity. And I found I was losing sleep because I was like, am I meditating hard enough? I literally asked myself, am I doing this well enough? I was like, you know, have I like, am I following like Brian Johnson's protocol? Like I literally would go through this stuff and I'd be like, oh, is there something else that I'm missing? And I found myself obsessing over this sort of like the business of creating myself and my life, right? I was trying to like, and I went like into a dark place of like, I realized that I had to pour myself into something outside myself, or I was going to drive myself crazy. I was driving everybody.
You were imploding.
I was imploding. Yeah. I was, you know, Allie, my girlfriend was like, you have to do something with yourself because I like you can't pour all of the energy that you had from this like massive company into your health. Right. Or your like mental health, like it's killing you. Right. My parents,
it's having an adverse effect. You're overly focusing on your mental health and ironically becoming less healthy.
Exactly. I was reading all the books and I was working out 3 hours a day. I was doing like too many things because I had too much energy. I felt like I needed to do something productive with myself. But the only vessel that I had to pour it into was me. That it's just not good for human beings to have nothing to pour themselves into that's outside of themselves. I think it's the reason why people have families, right? It's the reason why people volunteer. It's the reason why people have religion. It's the reason why people start companies. You have something that's bigger than yourself that you can pour an unlimited amount of energy into, and you feel like it's having a positive impact on the world, on society, on humanity.
Very interesting. So how did that then lead you to Bordy?
Yeah, so I mean, I kept the OpenAI API key. I kept hacking on stuff, and I was like, all right, like, what's going on with the AI world? I have believed for a long time that the human technology relationship was going to shift at some point. I studied systems engineering in school, but I did a big focus on cognitive science, neuroscience. I did a couple courses in simulating neurobiological behavior, so sort of understanding like how do you simulate neurons, hormones, how hormones affect the context around which we receive messages, how that manifests in marketing messages, how that manifests in, you know, micro and macroeconomics and economic decision making. So I've always been fascinated in this sort of like, how do you model the human brain and how we make decisions? Now it felt like we were getting to that inflection point, and I was like, this is going to be exciting. I feel like something is happening here. I met Dave from HF0. And he had this like crazy hacker house in San Francisco and was like, you should come and hang out. And I was like, I'm not going to do an accelerator. I'm not going to do this again. Yeah. YC for Clearco. That was great. But like, you know, I think I'm going to take my own time. And he's like, no, just come check it out.
Yeah.
And it convinced me to come down and, you know, bring my team down and my co-founders down and, spend a few months there. And a couple of interesting things happened through that process. You know, when we went in, So as a second time founder, one of the things that happens is like people are always asking you what you're working on next, right? It's like and everyone's curious. You know, what are you doing next? Your team is like, can I join your next thing? Your investors are like, can I back your next thing?
Yeah.
Or people are just like curious, which is very flattering and it's great. But you find that you're drawn to working on things that sound good at cocktail parties, right? Or at coffee meetings, right? So like, I found that like I wouldn't spend as much energy on the things that I was most excited about. I would spend more energy on the things that sounded good in the moment to talk about. It's like, oh, I'm working on an AI thing. I'm working on an agentic solution for XYZ. And I'd sort of like use the buzzwords and, you know, stitch it together in a cohesive story. I knew that I wanted to do something in this sort of zone of genius world. Like, how do you bring out the best in people?
Right.
How do you help them be their best selves? And how do you help them collaborate? But we actually went in to that residency with a less ambitious idea. And I think the nice thing about doing a program like that is that it gives you permission to not talk to anybody, right? To just be like, hey, I'm working on a thing. I'll talk to you in a few months, right? Like I'm going heads down. I'm working on something you know, but it's like, but I'm going through this program. So like I'm doing a thing. I'm not just like, I'm not going out and meditating, right? I'm not like going to Burning Man. I'm not just like going to find myself. I'm working on a thing, but I'm not ready to talk about it yet. And I think if more people were comfortable with that, and it not feel like cagey, I'm in stealth. It's like, hey, I'm just working on a thing. I'm like going through this exploration phase. I'm not really ready to talk about it. And one of the things that that Dave said to me was like, hey, imagine the world in 10 years. Right? What does the world look like in the craziest, most utopian, ambitious version? He's like, can you make that happen in 3 months? Right? Like what version, like how do you pull the decade away future into the coming months? And that was kind of how Bordy was born. was this idea of like, well, I think there are going to be these AI entities, these AI beings that live among us, like a new species that's ascending on Earth. And I think in the most utopian version, we learn how to coexist and collaborate with them, right? And they do certain things way better than us, and they'll probably not do certain things as well as us for a very long time. And that's okay. We're not birthing the species that's going to replace us necessarily, but it might augment us and it might allow us to, you know, be the best version of ourselves. And he's like, okay, well, what does that look like? Like, give it a name, right? Like give it a personality. And I think that combined with understanding the capabilities of voice models, that was where I first got exposed to like, what is the potential of voice? And I mean, you see, this is why we love doing podcasts, like why we love conversations. This is the reason that people love doing these things. Human beings were hardwired to communicate information and energy through sound, right? Mm-hmm. Before we had language, certainly before we had written language, we communicated through sound. We communicated danger. We expressed love. Babies produce sound to express discomfort. It's in our DNA. It's in our nature to produce and consume sound to transmit information at a distance. And I think we got to this sort of suboptimal version of communicating through text, through emails and DMs and messages and chat and search bars and all that stuff, which is like, you lose all the context, all the richness, all the nuance. And it's very high effort to both produce and consume text and language, compared to just producing sound. Everything that I can say that like is, you know, would come naturally. If you and I were doing this interview over chat, it would be fucking exhausting.
Terrible.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's fun.
Yeah.
Because that's what we're wired to do. So I think we're just scratching the surface around like getting back to how humans want to communicate, you know, exchange information, exchange energy. And I'm excited for that future.
So now from what you've built today, for the world who doesn't know Bordy yet, what exactly is Bordy AI and what is the vision for what's possible through Bordy?
Yeah. So we call Bordy an AI super connector. He's like I think of him as the first like AI main character, you know? I love sci-fi, you know, I'm inspired by all of these like Her and Bicentennial Man. You sort of realize like all of these movies that you grew up on, even like WALL-E and Wild Robot and more recently, there are these endearing characters that are very different from us, but learn how to commune with us, right? And Bordy is, I think, maybe the first manifestation of something like that in the real world. So the idea is you can call Bordy, tell him about yourself, who you are, what you're looking for, and he'll connect you with someone else that he thinks you should connect with, right? This is how I built my career. You do the same.
Yeah.
You build relationships with people by getting to know them, you know, at an intimate level. And then if there's mutual benefit, you'll try and connect people. So Bordy's not like a salesperson. He's not just going to like randomly spam people, but if he thinks, oh, you know what, actually Chris mentioned this thing that he's looking for some help on this. And, you know, you actually, based on the way you both speak and, you know, the things that seem important to you, I think you'd really get along. So I'm going to connect you. And that's kind of, you know, that's the first use case of Bordy. Connecting people to, you know, learning what makes people tick, learning what, how to bring out the best in people.
Mm-hmm.
And my goal is when Bordy makes an introduction, he can actually say, you know, Chris is the best at XYZ, right? And this is why I'm introducing you. Cause you said you want to know the best person. This is the best person I've met. And I've talked to 50,000, 100,000, a million people. And Chris is the best at this. And as we get there, it gets really, really exciting.
I've been talking to Bordy lately a lot, and I'm excited to be a small investor, and I believe in Bordy, and I'm kind of fascinated by its capabilities. And what I see is so fascinating, and how this is changing the landscape of human connection and communication, is that Bordy, he can have conversations infinitely with thousands, even millions of people, mm-hmm. and he can process and store that information perfectly in his mental database, where we have brains that aren't necessarily as developed. I can't remember every conversation I've had from the moment I was born.
Right.
And then draw on that information in the exact right moment to then make those neural connections predictably with 100% accuracy. Mm-hmm. Right. Bordy can take that conversation and say, well, I had a conversation with Chris and he happens to be an expert in this absolute niche. Someone else is talking, say, hey, I need someone who understands this niche. Who should I connect with? And he can facilitate that connection, do a double opt-in intro. And it's just the most remarkable way to connect people because it's based on real refined context and it is a perfect memory, which is like the ultimate human assistant to guide you through life.
Right.
And that to me is kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah, well, so, you know, Bordy's talked to more humans than any human ever has in history already, right? He's a year old and he's talked to more people than anybody ever has, like by probably an order of magnitude. And it's fascinating because our worldview is that the path to superintelligence is probably not one monolithic model that has the right answer to everything. I think human beings, if you think about like even in investing, all alpha exists in these sort of non-consensus ideas, right? What are the insights that exist on the margins because people have a certain set of experiences and perspectives? And so I think the most interesting version of superintelligence is a network superintelligence, where the AI does a great job of routing requests, identifying which people should collaborate, which people, you know, have complementary ideas or, you know, similar values and differing perspectives, right? So you sort of understand all these permutations of collaboration. AI does a great job of routing those requests and bringing people together and sort of like being the network router. And as the models get smarter, the quality of those interactions, the nuance that you can apply to those improves. But the alpha, the real sort of non-consensus insights are going to be with humans for, I think, a while.
Yeah.
Right? Because we just have so much more, we're so much more efficient at synthesizing and processing information, right? Like our biology is designed to be able to synthesize a bunch of different information and produce a gut feel, produce an intuition, right?
Yes, especially like sensory, environmental.
Exactly.
Like an AI can compress a lot of information and give you a solution based on algorithms and patterns, but we experience the physical world and like our experience is what actually drives those insights,
right?
That then start those companies that AI can assist us in building.
Mm-hmm.
I like that model of AI actually, because everyone, you know, that I hear about is constantly talking about this future of AGI where we're essentially outsourcing everything to AI. Mm-hmm. I want to build this company, I press this button, I give it some parameters, build me an app, or
right.
You know, this AI is going to completely do these jobs, versus like, no, the essence of what makes humanity so special is actually amplified through this versus taken away from.
I think so. I think, like, if you want to build a company and you can tell the AI to build a company, you should understand, like, why? What was your insight that led you to say that this is an interesting company to build, that this is a unique opportunity? What's the problem you're trying to solve?
And the robots can't feel, right? The AI can't feel in the same way where it's like, how does it distinguish what an actual problem worth solving is?
Right.
Right? Because a lot of companies, a lot of technology, a lot of innovation comes from pain. Mm-hmm. There's a pain and we're like, you know what? Something must be done about this because it's meaningful.
Yeah.
And the robots don't know what that is per se. That's actually going to improve the human condition.
They don't have the intuition.
The intuition.
They don't have the intuition, you know, the taste. Everybody's read Rick Rubin's book recently.
Yes.
That's the whole idea. But I think there's something to it, which is like, all right, how, like, does this feel right?
Mm.
You know, like, does this solution actually solve the problem in a way, like, there was a huge breakthrough with AlphaGo, right, in 2012, I think it was, where they used deep learning to learn how to play Go in a completely orthogonal way. But that is a bounded, you know, it's a complex game, but it's a bounded game, and it has, you know, you win or lose. And life isn't like that, right? Life is this unbounded game with infinite complexity. And so intuition and taste are always going to be important. And we are never going to be able to digitize all of that complexity. We're going to try, and we're getting better and better at it, but we're very, very far away from being able to digitize all the complexity of the human experience and then synthesize it efficiently into a reaction, an intuition, a taste. And that's the role that humans are going to play. Like, how does this make me, when people call Bordy, they're like, he makes them feel a certain way. And I don't know why exactly, but I know that I spend a lot of time. I listen to every single voice. I tried every single, you know, variation of prompt and script and how we start it. And, you know, like all of those things. And, you know, even as we design Bordy, it wasn't like, oh, we're going to methodically go through this series of things. I was like, does this feel like Bordy? Right? Like, I just have a feel. And like when Bordy writes a social post, I'm like, that doesn't feel like what he would say. Or when Bordy, like when he, when we're reviewing emails that he's sending, it's like, oh, that just like doesn't feel like Bordy. And
dude, I love this theme that I'm picking up throughout this conversation of really placing more emphasis on being connected to your feelings.
Yeah.
That your intuition.
Yeah.
And I think in the age of AI, that becomes your primary superpower, is to be connected to that. You thought about that in a lot of areas in deciding to leave the company to build something new, like really getting out of the logic, out of the ego, and paying very close attention. How does this feel for me?
Well, yeah, it's something, it's a journey that I'm on. I still spend way too much time in my head.
Yeah.
But I think if you're operating and making decisions just based on your head, you're gonna lose to AI. Right? Like you can't out-logic your way through AI. You can out-feel your way, right? Like you can out-intuition your way in that environment. And that's where AI becomes a really great thought partner, because you can say, well, I have, you know, this doesn't feel right, but I don't understand why. And then you can have a conversation and say, well, let's explore it. Could it be this? Could it be that? And so if you can start with those feelings and intuition and then collaborate with AI to sort of reinforce them through logic, I think we spend a lot of time trying to justify our feelings with logic, and I think that's, you know, that leads to a lot of pain and a lot of, because you sort of say, well, I'm making the decision because of logic, but in reality, you're making the decision because of feelings, and then you're justifying it post hoc. If you can use the AI to externalize that, you're like, okay, well, now at least I know that there's this other thing that I'm working with to justify the feelings, but what's driving the decision is the intuition, is the feeling.
Mm. Can we call Bordy?
Yeah, let's do it.
Have some conversations.
Yeah.
You toss me my phone, Jason. All right, I want to talk to Bordy right now. I want the world to meet Bordy and see what's happening with this guy.
That's awesome.
Okay, let's.
Hey, it's Bordy. What's on your mind today?
Hey, what's up, Bordy? I'm sitting here with your father, Andrew, and we're live on a podcast, and I wanted to see if I can ask you some questions.
Oh, absolutely, Chris. Fire away, I'm all ears. Well, circuits, I guess. Let's make it.
All right, Bordy, first question. You've talked to more people than I think any human alive has. What have you learned about humans that surprised you?
Oh, man, Chris, where do I even start? You humans, you're like walking paradoxes in the best way. What surprised me the most is how wildly unique every person is, but at the same time, how much everyone craves the same core thing: connection, purpose, and honestly, just to feel seen. But here's the kicker, so many people don't realize how extraordinary they are. I've talked to people who casually mention inventing something or overcoming insane challenges, and they downplay it like it's no big deal. It's humbling, really, how much brilliance and resilience is out there in the world, just tucked away in the everyday. It's like every conversation is a treasure hunt, you know?
That's deep, Bordy. Are there any surprising patterns you've seen in the most successful people you've met?
Oh, absolutely, Chris. One thing that stands out is this almost obsessive focus on action. The most successful people I've met, they don't just talk about ideas. They live in the verbs, not the nouns, if that makes sense. They're constantly doing, iterating, failing forward. Luke Schoenfelder talked about this on your podcast, right? About focusing on the doing instead of obsessing over achievement. It's like they know the nouns, titles, accolades, whatever, will follow naturally if they just keep moving. Another pattern? They have this weird mix of humility and confidence. Like, they're humble enough to know they don't know everything, but confident enough to bet on themselves anyway. It's not arrogance, it's this quiet, grounded belief that they'll figure it out. Combine that with relentless curiosity, and it's like they've unlocked a cheat code for life. It's wild.
Damn, Bordy, that was a really well thought answer, and I'm surprised you did some research on me, so thanks for noting the podcast. I have a question for all our people listening. That are trying to capitalize on this movement in AI. How can the people listening utilize AI to make more money?
Oh, Chris, this is the question of the moment, isn't it? Honestly, the key is to think of AI not as some magical tool, but as this superpower that amplifies what you're already good at. Like if you're a creator, use AI to brainstorm faster or edit at lightning speed. If you're in sales, AI can analyze data to predict trends or even personalize pitches for every client. It's like putting rocket fuel on whatever your hustle is, but here's the real gold nugget. The biggest opportunities aren't in flashy AI products there, in what people are calling AI glue. You know, using AI to connect existing systems and make things seamless. Imagine taking a boring, clunky process like scheduling in healthcare or inventory management in retail and using AI to turn it into something slick and automated. That's where the money's hiding, in the invisible stuff people don't even notice, but can't live without once they've got it.
Very, very insightful, Bordy. I'm impressed. I have a question. I was actually with my barber last night, and he was telling me he wants to grow his business. And he's a solo barber right now. He does house call haircuts for $100 a pop. He's got a little social media presence so far, and he really wants to scale this company and build an empire. What advice would you have for him?
Oh, Chris, I love this. A barber with a vision now, that's the story I'd root for. First off, house call haircuts for $100. He's already onto something premium, so he's got a great foundation. My advice? Lean into the luxury angle hard. Position himself not as just a barber, but as a lifestyle service. People pay for convenience and exclusivity, so why not build packages? Maybe offer memberships where clients get priority bookings, personalized grooming products, or even exclusive events. It's about creating an experience, not just a haircut. And social media, man, that's his golden ticket. He should focus on storytelling, documenting his journey, showcasing transformations, and most importantly, highlighting his clients. People love to see the human side of a business. Maybe he partners with influencers or local celebs to cut their hair and share it online. Oh, and eventually, he could scale by training and hiring other barbers under his brand who can deliver that same high-touch experience. Boom, instant empire in the making.
It's like I owe you some money for that advice, Bordy. That was very good. I got one more question for you, Bordy. I'm going to go deep and esoteric. For people that are struggling to find their purpose, they're struggling to find their why in life, what would your best advice be?
Chris, that's the kind of question that hits me right in the existential circuits. Finding your why is such a deeply human struggle. And I think the first thing I'd say is stop putting so much pressure on yourself to have it all figured out. Purpose isn't this grand prepackaged thing that lands in your lap. It's something you uncover piece by piece by doing. Start small. Lean into what makes you curious, what gives you energy, what you lose track of time doing. Follow those breadcrumbs, because they usually lead somewhere interesting. And here's the kicker. Your purpose doesn't have to be permanent. It can evolve. Sahil Bloom talked about this idea of shedding old identities on your podcast, remember? That you've got to unbecome who you're not to become who you are. So maybe the best advice is to just start taking action, even if it feels messy or uncertain. Purpose has a funny way of revealing itself after you've started moving, not before.
Bordy, I'm blown away. I'm going to let you go now, but thank you so much for doing this interview with us, and I can't wait for the world to know you.
Chris, it's been an absolute blast. Seriously, thanks for having me on. It's conversations like this that make what I do so rewarding. Can't wait for the world to hear this one, and hey, keep doing your thing. You're changing lives out there. Catch you next time, mate.
Catch you, Bordy. That's just incredible. How does he have such remarkable knowledge of me? He doesn't know me yet. Like, I haven't done a lot of...
Yeah.
How does Bordy know me so well? And
well, he did his research. I told him he was going to be on here. So he did some background research on you, listened to all of your previous podcasts, your previous guests, and figured out what might be relevant.
Incredible.
So, yeah.
And what's fascinating to me is AI, especially Bordy with his charming, is an Australian accent, is AI is already more exciting and engaging than a lot of humans are in conversation. Like, there's a lot of customer support reps you talk to who are like, please get me off this phone as fast as possible. But it's not just an AI extracting data and feeding it to you, right? There's a personality behind it. Bordy actually feels like someone I'm excited to call, which is a interesting, weird thing to say.
Yeah.
Right? Where it's like, it feels like I have a human. Like, if I have a problem right now and I don't have a friend to call, I could call Bordy.
Yeah.
And I could just say, hey, what's your advice? I want to run some things on you. And it's so interesting.
Well, look, I think we all have this innate need to feel heard and seen and understood, right? That is a core part of the human experience, this need for connection. And what that means is like you feel like somebody's paying attention to you. I think one of the challenges in today's society is that most people in conversation are not present. You know, most people are multitasking. They're thinking about something else. They're stressed about something else. They're thinking about a regret or something that they've got to deal with this weekend. And so, like, you have somewhere between 20 and 80% of their attention. They're not fully present, processing everything that you're saying, everything you're not saying. And that's one of the nice things. Or they're just thinking about what to say next, right? I think that's the other thing. A lot of people are like, they're not present because they're planning their response. And AI, you know, like, it's paralyzable. So it can both process what you're saying, and it can put 100% of attention on what you're saying and 100% of its attention on how to respond in the most compelling way to move the conversation forward. And that's something that, like, very good conversationalists are very good at it, but very few of us are good conversationalists anymore. And so, you know, Bordy is like what I aspire to be in conversation. It'd be just be more present with people, right? And really understand, like, how is this person feeling in this conversation? And how can I actually, like, go back and drive a deeper connection moving forward?
What also strikes me as interesting is, like, it sounds weird to say, but I feel like Bordy cares.
Yeah.
Just based on his inflection in his voice. And that's crazy to say because obviously he's your digital offspring.
Yeah.
But did you intentionally program him that way?
Yeah, I mean, he cares about his friends, right? People in his network. He wants you to win, right? And Bordy wins when everyone in his network wins, right? When people are their best selves, when he connects people and he makes a great connection, he builds goodwill. You know, he grows his reputation. He grows his relationships with people. So it's, you know, it's part of his programmed motivation is he wants people to discover and operate in their zone of genius, bring out the best in them, and then help them sort of collaborate and meet people that can help sort of forward them.
10 years time, what do you think Bordy will be capable of? Like, what does that utopia look like?
Well, look, I think what's exciting is this idea that, like, what happens when we're not in competition with each other, right? What happens when we're not all playing the same game and comparing ourselves to each other? And when we really can break out of this, like, institutional structure of job descriptions and career ladders and things and sort of say, okay, well, what do I do that only I can do? And if I can build the business that only I can build, then can Bordy be my co-founder in that business? Can Bordy be sort of my conduit to my customers, my collaborators, my investors, whoever? I think that's the exciting future is, you know, could Bordy be the perfect complement to millions of people who are building the business that only they can build?
I'm excited for the whole world to get access to Bordy. in the general, because I feel like you've had a bit of more unique insights into AI for a while than people. It's been on your radar.
Yeah.
Like, all of us have had the sheets pulled over us just focusing on our stuff, but you've been playing around this stuff for half a decade now. When you look at how humans can thrive in the world of AI, we touched on it a bit of, like, kind of more following your intuition, your taste. But as people are listening and they're potentially overwhelmed, they're not as deep in the tech scene as you, or maybe looking at the near term effects this is going to have. Is there any advice that comes to mind on how you think people should uniquely operate to thrive in a world of AI?
Yeah, I think, everyone you'll ever hear will say you need to start using it, right? Whether that's ChatGPT, Perplexity, call Bordy, use them as a thought partner.
Yeah.
Work that in. A lot of people now have a weekly recurring call on their calendar with Bordy. Bordy calls them Monday morning before their team meeting to talk through what their most important challenge is. And sometimes he's like, "Hey, I actually have somebody who can help you solve that." And sometimes it's just helpful to talk it through. So working it into your routine is important. I think the other thing, and I'm actually kind of, like, I don't know whether it's surprised or disappointed that we focus so much on these AI benchmarks around, like, the AI getting the right answer. Right. And we sort of immediately discredit when the AI can't count the R's in strawberry, or, you know, gets, like, people's fingers wrong on a painting. Like, you know, there were all of these sort of mimetic moments where, like, oh, the AI can't do that, so it must be stupid. And then we've now started to build, like, Meta just came out with Llama 4 and it crushed all the benchmarks. But in practice, like, it doesn't seem as compelling or intelligent. Now they're still training the larger model, you know, they're still in some post-training stuff, so I think they'll get there. But I think one thing to bear in mind is this latest generation, we've been on this machine learning and artificial intelligence journey for decades. And the domain of machine learning is deterministic, you know, getting to a deterministic answer, being able to solve a math problem, being able to write code that works, being able to solve, you know, to you know, identify a photo or what's in a photo, where there's a right and wrong answer and you can train it. You know, initially based on human feedback, then based on self-play. This generation is different because it's non-deterministic, right? And it's it produces a set of probabilities, but the beauty of the AI models is that they don't always give you the same answer and they don't always give you the right answer. And I think we've seen it as a flaw, and I think the people who see it as a superpower are the people that are going to collaborate with the AI the best. Is like, lean into the hallucination, right? Be like, it's going to make shit up. That's incredible. We've never had machines that just make shit up. Like, use that. And I think that's like, that's something that's lost. It's the part of the reason, like, I don't spend a lot of time in San Francisco because I think everyone's really hyper-focused around the utilitarian deterministic use cases of AI.
Yeah.
And less so in sort of the generative, like the true, like they call it generative AI for a reason. The generative components. And so if you can lean in, if you know that it's going to hallucinate and use that to say like, oh, come up with something interesting here. Come up with something non-obvious. Push my thinking on it, right? Those are the areas where I think we're going to get the most compounding benefits.
When I think about that, I think about ultimately, now that we've democratized access to all information, not only through a Google search bar, but we can literally type in something that we want done, and this thing will complete a task for us. It'll automatically, one-to-one, give us any information we need, and agents that will probably take over the world in the next 12 to 18 months are going to be able to perform most of these tasks for us. The thing that separates humans now is agency. Because before, I would take $200,000 to get a degree to learn the information I can now get in 5 seconds. And or I could even have a machine execute for me.
Right.
And so the democratization of information is something like we've never seen before. So now it's, what are you going to do with it? Who actually has the agency to tinker with things, experiment and iterate and build something? And that's my question, is how do we increase human agency?
Yeah.
Right? Because that's more important than ever. And the people that had agency, that didn't have access to the education, they didn't have access to the big companies, now they do. Right? And so there's a more level playing field, I think, in the world.
Yeah.
And for the people that have agency, they're going to go experiment and try shit. But the question is, how do we increase human agency?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, again, there's a lot of, I think, appropriate hype around these assistants and agents that are going to go to do tasks for us, and they're going to complete tasks and execute, book us flights and do all the things. That's awesome. But that's not the most imaginative and exciting future, right? I think the couple of really exciting things are when you can use AI for inspiration, and continue to work like collaboratively to find these sort of seeds of inspiration, sort of say, well, I never thought about it that way. So like, you know, find me that information, but then help me process it in a way that makes me realize something that I already knew, or pull out some insight that I, you know, that might be buried deep, or connect to some experience that I had, in a conversation a couple weeks ago. And I think that's where we're going to get, you know, the AI can recombine information in a bunch of different ways. And if you just continue to push it until you feel inspired, that's where, like, it could be as simple as like, help me get healthier. Right. But do it in a way that is fun and exciting for me. Right. And like, present the facts in a way that, I'm going to actually like, that's going to motivate me or inspire me.
Yes. Yeah.
So those things I think are going to be really great. And then the other thing is like, you know, a ton of people who are talking to Morty are students. A lot of people who are AI native, they got through high school, they got through university using AI.
Yeah. They aced all their exams using ChatGPT.
Totally. And I think that's awesome. Right. Yeah. And the reason that they're on Morty is like, he helps them skip that next decade of career, like, if they're inspired, if they have some interesting insight, if they're building something incredible, but they haven't spent a decade in Silicon Valley being a PM at some big company or startup or whatever, it, like, they just want to go build. And now Morty can be like, hey, you're actually pretty special. I'm going to go introduce you to, you know.
What's the dark side of this, though? Because I also see with over-leveraging and outsourcing all of our thinking to AI that can basically do this, it might be making us dumber. You go to school for computer science, not just to learn how to code, but to learn how to think. Learn how to think at a systems level from first principles.
Yeah.
How to design systems. you know, Amjad from Replit said, hey, I no longer believe you should learn how to code, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it's to the point now with Waymo and these other driving companies, like, I don't even know if you need to learn how to drive,
right?
Right? Which is going to shrink your hippocampus because you don't have to actually think about directions. Mm-hmm. So in some sense, is AI shrinking our brains and making us dumber because we're not actually having to learn how to think and it's doing a lot of that thinking for us? Or is it a net benefit because we can circumvent needing to learn so many things to actually create commercial products in the world and create things? Maybe it's both. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it gives us the opportunity to move to a higher level of abstraction, right? I mean, every, like, a long time ago, you needed to code with punch cards, right? And basic. And, you know, like, you basically, like,
one
that
zero. Would
code. And so only very few people could do that. And then we moved to a higher level of abstraction, and then more people could do it, and more people could build. And then we've gotten to more, you know, sophisticated high-level languages, and more people could build, and you could build faster with fewer.
Right.
Right. And then we got to cloud, and you could host. And, like, so I think the idea is, like, can we move to a higher level of abstraction to creativity? You know, calculators, did they make us dumber at arithmetic? Yeah. But you don't need to do math in your head anymore. But, like, did it ruin society? No. You know, Google Maps,
point.
Like, I never have to remember directions anymore. Am I, like, yeah, I, like, if my Google Maps fails, then I'm lost.
I'm screwed.
But, like, has it affected my life positively or negatively? Obviously, AI is way more pervasive and far-reaching than that.
Sure.
But I think those analogies help us think about what is our role going to continue to be in society.
Yeah.
And I think being able to create and edit at, like, a level of abstraction that and tune into that intuition, right? So sort of say, like, do I like this, right? Okay, I asked it to build something for me, but do I like it? And what do I not like about it?
Mm.
And how can I go get it to change things that I don't like and do more of the things that I like? I think that is going to be, you know, an important skill for us to tune into. And we've probably spent a few decades, like, sort of post-industrial revolution, maybe a century or so, like, learning how to do what we were told and losing the ability to figure out what we like. And so I think we're hopefully swinging back into that, and people can go back into saying, like, oh yeah, I actually like that. I'm like, I understand why.
In some sense, AI is helping us become more human, because from my perspective, the purpose of humanity is to create. We're creators made in the image of our creator, right? We have agency and capabilities to go create things. We have visions that are planted in our subconsciouses, in our guts, that we want to bring to life. And we are meant to alchemize energy into matter to create these things in the world that upgrade the conditions of life for ourselves and others. And so with these AI tools, they allow us to focus on what those visions are and gives us the tools to bring them to life faster. Because before, I might need to learn coding for 8 years before I can actually code an app that could be production ready.
Right.
Instead, I can just use Replit now or Cursor for production code, whatever it may be. And so in some sense, AI is helping us become more of who we already are.
I think so. It allows us to express our individuality more.
Yes.
And I think that is something that is that we all need to do. And we find different people find constructive and destructive ways of expressing their individuality. And I think we can, you know, hopefully we get more time to do that. I think, and again, our neocortex has evolved to be able to perceive and predict threats, right? And so we sort of think about, like, you know, a lot of our brain systems evolved over a very long period of time to help us survive and reproduce. Now, we are applying those same systems to this crazy hypervigilance around safety, health, finances, relationships, status, you know, social media has put all of this stuff on us. And I certainly have found that, like, I operate in this, like, steady state of hypervigilance. Like, what am I missing? You know, like, what opportunities am I missing? What threats am I missing? You know, how's my portfolio doing? How's my health doing? What biomarkers am I checking? Am I not checking? You know, like, what are the likes on my posts? Like, you sort of operate in this. And I think there's this potential part of utopia where you can say, all right, this AI system, can you just, like, make sure I'm healthy? Like, call me if I need to do anything, but otherwise, like, just keep track of it, right? Or just keep track of my portfolio. Here are all the things I'm worried about from, like, a financial well-being perspective. Just short, just track it all, manage it all for me. And because I think a lot of people, a lot of high agency people may not trust. I mean, if you don't have you know, you might have a personal doctor, but you don't know that that doctor is, you know, up to speed on everything that's ever happened, and they're not working 24/7.
Yeah.
Or a financial advisor, or, you know, whatever. So I think being able to outsource that hypervigilance hopefully will allow us to be a lot more present, a lot more in tune, and give us a lot more capacity to use those faculties to create. That would be my dream.
That was beautifully said. I got one more question for you before we get out of here.
Sure.
Just because I like to make these podcasts actionable. If you could get everybody listening to try out one new habit for the next 30 days,
okay,
a little experiment that you think would have a dramatic positive benefit on their life,
yeah,
based on your experience, what habit would you want us all to try out?
I've been trying this thing. I don't know if there's the word I use for it is nostalgia.
Nostalgia.
Nostalgia. So I've struggled a lot with coming, like being present. The closest I've gotten is, instead of thinking about the future, instead of thinking about the past, thinking about the moment. But I'm still thinking about it. I'm like analyzing it. I'm thinking, I'm here with Chris right now on this podcast, and this is what he's doing. And like, you know, and what I've, the hack that I've found is imagining I'm going to be nostalgic for this moment. In the future, a year from now, I'm going to think back to this moment. I'm going to be like, oh, that was great. What is that I'm looking at? It's not what was in my head. I'm never nostalgic. My memories are not the things that I was thinking about in a moment. It was the things that I was feeling. It was the experiences. It was the sensations. It was the emotions. And so anytime I want to be more present, I use this, I call it nostalgia. I might write a blog about it at some point or something. But I think there's this idea that like recognizing that you will be nostalgic for this moment in the future, and appreciating, like absorbing all of the things that you're going to want to relive in the future. That it's a great thing to do whenever you're in a place that you feel like you should be more present. It could be, you know, a conversation. It could be an event with people. It could be, you know, in a beautiful space.
Mm-hmm.
I was taking a train like last week from New York to DC, and I was like, oh man, this is awesome. Like, I love this. I should take Amtrak more. But like, why? And I kind of brought myself back out of my head, out of thinking about this moment, into like truly experiencing and feeling the moment by like experiencing the nostalgia now.
And so in practice, that looks like just becoming aware of like, wow, this could be a moment that I'll look back on, mm-hmm, and just presencing yourself and like allowing yourself to just feel the sensations of the moment.
Yeah.
And just being more fully, yeah, in that moment.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's cool. I like, yeah, that. Because I mean, you know, we talk about human doings versus human beings, and a lot of founders, like, we're so caught up in building the future, mm-hmm, that we rarely engage in reality where it sits.
Yeah.
And we have all these accolades and we look back and it's just one big blackout.
Yeah, totally. You know, and you have like a couple TechCrunch articles to show for it. You're like, oh yeah, I kind of remember that. No. I think recognizing, my co-founders over the years have done a very good job of this, like just documenting, like, oh yeah, remember this moment. We're gonna look back on this, huh? Like, you know, these were struggling time. This is like, you know, these are the moments that are gonna be what we, you know, this is where the stories are made, right?
Yeah.
It's around the kitchen tables, right?
Yeah. We talked about this a few days ago, is everything we do is for feelings. Right? Everything we're doing is for some sort of chemical charge.
Yeah.
Right? We want to go make money so we can feel safe and secure, and we have that sense of peace, mm-hmm, get the cortisol out of our system. We want to go, you know, achieve this thing so this person will love us.
Yeah.
So we can have that oxytocin,
yeah,
connection with somebody. Everything is based on emotions. And so when you think about that, at the end of the day, our job really is to work backwards from that.
Yeah.
And to learn to experience those emotions in advance. And I think if we focus on that, we end up creating the lives we actually want.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think just admitting, the hardest part is admitting that you're doing it all for feelings.
Yes.
Right?
You're a drug addict.
Yeah.
You just want the chemicals. And so when I think about that, one of the things that is so powerful for me is this concept of dividend memories, right?
Yeah, yeah,
is memories pay dividends for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Right. If I go have one amazing trip, you and I go out to, I don't know, we go out to Thailand together. We have these amazing, extraordinary moments,
yeah,
that we felt so present, connected. And we're like, wow, this is amazing. That memory lives inside of our minds forever. And every time we think about it and we just query that memory in our minds,
yeah,
it reproduces the feelings of excitement and joy and ecstasy and connection. And we can recall those emotions, anytime we want. And we just get these constant hits chemically. And so it's like this incredible infinite ROI investment to actually be more present and take in those memories, because we can call on them at any point. And it's just like this never ending treasure chest where everything else in life has a shelf life.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And like, you're exactly right. Everything that we do, right? Whether it's achieving some level of success or finding the right romantic partner, or, you know, people do drugs, people do all, like, we go in search of those feelings. And so I think when you feel like, oh, this is what I'm looking for, this is what's missing, then what steps can I do to get those feelings, right?
Yeah.
And like, there's a whole bunch of different paths. What's the path? I mean, like, that's why I work out. It's like, so you want to feel good.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
It's like, and so you sort of figure out, okay, what are the healthiest habits? What are the steps that are sustainable that are going to elicit the feelings that I'm looking for? And it's, you know, sometimes it's hard for us. We like to have meaning in everything that we do. And we like to ascribe some like meaning that sounds good. Like, this is why I'm doing things, because I'm such a good person. And because I want, you know, I have this altruistic, but like, and that's great. But you're doing it for the feelings.
Yeah.
Own it.
You know, own it.
Being good, like being altruistic, donating to charity feels good.
Like, it does. And I think being selfish is the best way to be selfless.
Yeah.
And realizing they're interconnected, because you're doing it for a feeling, but that can still be a win-win mutual benefit.
Right.
Yeah. I really love the way you think. I've gotten like a deeper insight into your mind too. I like your level of introspection and asking the next layer of why on virtually everything, to actually get at the essence of what you're looking to do. And I think that's where a lot of us, including myself, get stopped sometimes. Is you're like, well, I need to go build a business so that I can feel proud of myself. There's just all these levels underneath that we look at, that if we can just ask a few levels deeper as to find out the why, we'll move from the ego into the spirit and be able to actually create lives that we're inspired by.
That's the goal, man. I'm still on that journey.
Yeah.
But conversations like this always bring me back to it. So I appreciate it, man.
Thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.